Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with My Science. Oh, this is for March 21st, 2024, and a very, very, very important show tonight. I can't stress how very important this is. Okay, so let's jump right into this. Here's the deal. In a couple weeks, a few short weeks, there's going to be a major solar eclipse. That means that the moon is going to move between Earth and the Sun. And the reason this doesn't happen every month is because the moon's orbit is at an angle. It's at an angle with the orbit of Earth passing around the Sun in Earth's orbit, around the Sun. And so only occasionally do these two events line up, where the moon crosses the ecliptic at the same time as the full moon, and therefore comes directly between us and the sun. And so the swipe of totality across the United States, it starts in Texas and goes up through the Northeast. So I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about that, but apparently there's all kinds of schools are closing. They're saying stock up on food. That it's going over the San Andreas Fault. And yes, there is a increased propensity for earthquakes when you have the sun and the moon aligning. Now, the sun is really, really big, but it's far away. The moon is much smaller, of course, but it's much closer. And so I'll go into a little bit about the dynamics of this. This is called a tidal force. It's not a direct it's due to gravity, but it's kind of subtle. So let me just start off with that so you understand what the cause of this is. Now, when you first start studying gravitational forces, you have a mass, and it's usually in the form of a pinpoint. In fact, actually a point that's so small that it's literally a point. Has no dimensions, and that would be the location of a mass. And then you have another mass, which is another point source, and you go through equations, Newton's laws, etc., studying these masses and their interaction, how they go orbit each other. And then quickly, this is one of the things I personally was studying back in my college years. It was one of my kind of pet projects when I understood that the analytics of analytical equations for orbital dynamics, it works very simply for two bodies orbiting each other. We understand that very well, and we can do the mathematics. It's a very simple closed set of equations, momentum, angular momentum, energy of the orbit, etc., etc. But you throw in a third body, and all of a sudden, nobody seems to be able to solve this. So I thought, okay, there must be a tool that we're missing, in terms of differential equations, in terms of, the mathematical tools that were available to study the motion of three-body systems, or n-body as it's called. So that's what I was studying when, during my years after, during and after college, would be in the like 1970s. I was in college up to 1970, and then after that, I kept studying this, and so I eventually put in electric and magnetic fields, and just to see what would happen, because they're very strange, the way electric fields, especially when you have something called orbital dynamics. Things are different. Things don't act the same as in static situations, like if you're standing on Earth and you do experiments. If you have a linear track or something and you're doing experiments, an air track, for example, and bouncing masses one against the other, that's one thing. But as soon as you get into orbital dynamics and circular motion of objects interacting with each other, then things get a little different. There's a different level on understanding centrifugal force and centripetal forces, etc. And so, anyway, I included electromagnetic fields, and that's what led me to the understanding that comets are not dirty snowballs. So I had understood this by the time I got to Cornell 1979, and all this data is coming in from electrical regions of the solar system. I recognized from my theoretical work that this is what was going on in outer space. But of course, the genre at the time was the belief system was such that they said there were no electric fields in outer space. And there couldn't be, although there were magnetic fields. And this is the bizarre thing, too. This total misunderstanding by standard science that somehow magnetic fields just appear. I just saw in a video the other day, some clown on the internet, I'm not going to say which channel to give him free advertisement, but has this authoritative English accent, sounds very convincing, talking about magnetic fields on the sun. Okay, well, that's great. Magnetic fields on the sun. But magnetic fields just don't appear by themselves. It's impossible. You need electrical currents, and those electrical currents cause magnetic fields. Magnetic fields in a plasma do not self-exist, very simply. Okay, so I'm going to jump off that bandwagon, get back to the topic at hand here about the eclipse coming up. And so getting back to the story of gravitation, here's how it works. When you're doing your theoretical work as a student, you're dealing with point masses and how they interact. But the moon is not a point source. It has physical size to it. So is the sun. And so how does this work? If you look at a gravitational field, it's radially outwards. It's like spokes on a wheel. You can imagine, like a balloon. Say you take a balloon and surround a gravitational object like the moon, and then you take and you cut out a piece of that balloon. Okay, if you put a balloon twice as far out from the center point of the moon, and you follow the lines out of that piece that you cut out of the balloon, if you go out twice the distance, you're going to get a piece that's four times larger. In a sense, the gravitational force is diminishing by the square of the distance between the moon, the center of the moon, and the object you're talking about, or in this case, the surface of the balloon. So this is called the 1 over r squared law. It's basic fundamental physics. Electricity also works the same. If you have charged particles, the electric forces are 1 over r squared forces. Okay, so now what happens is that if you take the moon has a physical size. It's not a point source. And then the moon, but the Earth also has physical size. So what happens? And this is the cause of what we call tidal forces. As the Earth spins underneath the moon, spins around once per day, the Earth spins around on its axis, and the moon is sitting out there. The Earth spins on its axis, so the moon pulls harder because the close side of Earth to the moon is closer to the moon than the center of Earth. It pulls harder. So it pulls up on the surface, and because the oceans are fluid, it creates a bulge, and that is the tide. Now, as the Earth spins, that means that that bulge follows the moon. And so the Earth is spinning on its axis and around the surface of the Earth. We have a 25,000-mile circumference, and it spins in about 24 hours. So the rule of thumb is that the surface of the Earth is spinning at around 1,000 miles per hour. And this is, by the way, when you go into orbit, you want to be as far south as possible, close to the equator, and going in the direction that the Earth is spinning, because that's 1,000 miles an hour that you don't have to expend energy as you go into orbit, which is about 17,000 miles an hour. So it takes off one of those thousands of miles per hour, such as a lot of energy. Okay, so anyway, the end result is that the Earth is pulled harder on the side closest to the moon, and it's pulled less hard with less force on the far side of Earth. And so that causes the far side of Earth to bulge out also, because the force is less. It's the average force is less than the force on the center of the Earth. So this causes a bulge on both sides of the Earth, one closest to the moon and one farthest away from the moon. And as the Earth spins, this bulge follows it. Okay, so anyway, that is the cause of the tidal forces. Now you get the moon aligned with the sun, and those two forces add up, and they're kind of like a pulse that comes along. Okay, so anyway, that's why there's a greater propensity for earthquakes when there's a full moon, or in this case, a new moon, where the moon is moving between Earth and the sun. And it's directly between us, not skewed down, not down below the plane of the Earth's orbit of the ecliptic, etc. So anyway, it's a little bit more than average full moon, or new moon in this case, where the new moon is when the moon is between Earth and the sun. And that's when it switches over from one side, from the morning to the evening, etc. Anyway. But the bottom line is, so there is a slight propensity greater. It's not a lot. It's really not much at all. In fact, it's not enough to write home about. It's not enough to close schools. It's not a reason to close schools, etc. But at any rate, here's the point. So there's all of this chatter, kind of like unwarranted chatter about some kind of danger. And I'm just here to tell you that even though there's a slight increase, it's not much. Okay, but that's not the point of my talk tonight. I just wanted to throw that in because probably everybody has heard some kind of horror story or fear-mongering on the internet or on the evening news even. They're even piling it on. I just wanted to say that there is a slight increased risk of earthquakes when there is a total eclipse. It's not that much more than normal when the moon is between Earth and the sun, but not perfectly between Earth and the sun. It's down a little bit in its orbit, so therefore we don't have a total eclipse. If the moon's orbit were in the ecliptic of Earth's orbit, that's ecliptic is another term for Earth's orbit around the sun. It's like a plane that Earth moves around the sun. If the moon's orbit lay perfectly in that plane, then every month we would have a total solar eclipse and a total lunar eclipse, where the Earth then would block the light to the moon coming from the sun. But that's not the case. And by the way, that's one of the very strong proofs that there was a grave interaction of some kind in recent history, which we know happened probably around 1500 BC. That's the best reckoning, and I don't pick dates. Those are dates picked by other people, but those are the best dates that are corroborated by old texts, in fact. Okay, so anyway, and that's not the point of my talk tonight either. Okay, so the point of my talk is dealing with general relativity. Very, very important. Some people are going, well, general relativity, only Einstein understands that. And really, I'll start out by telling you, Einstein did not cater to general relativity, even though he invented it. And so I'll talk about that a little bit. But it was a guy named Arthur Eddington who rammed it through into prominence by doing an experiment during a full total eclipse of the sun by the moon. And so anyway, I'll talk about that. And there's a number of aspects to general relativity. Some of it is good and bona fide and excellent thinking. The entire concept of the curved space-time, where Einstein mixed time in with the three-dimensional space, and then also did the adapted the mathematics, the tensor analysis, that allowed one to think in terms of curved space. And so his belief was that a mass, an object that had mass, distorted the space around it, and so therefore caused space to be curved. And you can imagine, here's another way of thinking about it. Imagine there's astronauts going around in the International Space Station around Earth. They're going in a circle. If you stand back and look at the International Space Station, it's going around in a circle around Earth in an orbit. It might be a slightly elliptical orbit, but we'll just for simplicity assume that's a circular orbit. But it's going in a circle when you're standing back and looking at it. But the astronauts in the International Space Station are weightless. And so as far as they're concerned, if they're doing an experiment in the space capsule, they're dealing with a gravitational system. It's like they were way out in outer space, away from everything else, just sitting still and weightless, because the centrifugal force is opposed by the gravitational force, which causes them to go in a circle. But in general relativity belief system, in terms of general relativity, they are living in a curved space environment, which is true. So it's just a different way of looking at things, and Einstein was very insightful about this. The problem comes in when you mix electromagnetic properties into this system, and this is what I was studying. And I realized that Einstein... Let me describe this a little bit differently, because Einstein did not believe relativity. He invented special relativity, which has to do with linear motion and relative frames of reference and the speed of light and things like that, which was true. It was very well proven, but general relativity was a different story. It's hard to get supermassive objects in your laboratory to do testing, so you have to depend on things out there in outer space, secondary tests. And so anyway, what I discovered was that they really made an error, and there's some thought experiments that go along with general relativity, curved space-time way of looking at things. So when you're dealing with a strictly gravitational system, space-time and curved space-time functions very well. But the problem is, as I said, when you bring in a beam of light. Now, a beam of light, let's take a star. It's, millions of years ago, shining light, and that light is coming to us along a direct line of sight. And the idea was that, these were thought experiments, the idea was that, let me walk through these. This is called the elevator example, or the principle of equivalence, also another term in general relativity. And here's how it works. Say you're in an elevator, you're in a box, and you do some experiments, and you have a light beam, you have a hole up on the side of the elevator, and a light beam comes in. You shine a light beam, a laser beam in, across, and you have a detector over on the other side, and the light beam comes in, goes straight across, hits the detector, and you go, oh, okay, the light beam is going straight as it should. But now you accelerate. You take this box that you're in, this elevator shaft that you're in, or elevator box or whatever, and you accelerate it at in one example is the gravity of Earth, 32.2 feet per second squared. So you get a rocket engine on this box, you accelerate it. Now what's going to happen? If you were going at a constant velocity, then the light beam would be moving with you and it would come across and there would be no difference in the experiment. But if you're accelerating, then what happens is that the light beam will seem to bend down because it comes in one side, but you're accelerating. By the time the light beam gets across the elevator box, the beam has gone straight, but your elevator box has gone up. So it appears to be following a curved line such as in space-time continuum, or following the same effect as gravity. So the thought experiment says that light should bend around a gravitational object in curved space-time. The only problem is you should be able to duplicate this in a laboratory, but like I say, it's hard to get something as big as the sun into your laboratory. So they devised an experiment to test this, and this is what you do in science. You devise an experiment. The only problem is the experiment was flawed, and I'll get into that in a minute. Now, this is coming up to the point where I'll give you the punchline right now. Tens of thousands of amateur astronomers live along this eclipse line, and probably tens of thousands more already have a hotel booked someplace or a motel where they're going to observe the total eclipse. These are people with telescopes. And I'll tell you something, the amateur telescopes that are available today are probably better equipped than Eddington's telescope back in the early 1900s. When he did this experiment, he went to an island and where there was a total eclipse and took a picture of the sky pattern, the star pattern around the sun during this total eclipse, and compared it to that same star pattern on a regular night without the sun in the way. Okay, so anyway, the end result of Eddington's experiment was allegedly that it proved that light bent around the sun, and this got publicized. It went, you know, viral, as they say, and then, but there's something that didn't happen. Nobody ever reproduced the Eddington experiment. A few people have tried it, but they didn't succeed. And then there have been some other experiments that have been tried. Hopefully I'll have time to get into those. But the end result is that Eddington faked the experiment. He took the data, cherry-picked the data points, and claimed that it proved general relativity. And what I'm going to tell you tonight is that Eddington faked the data. He took the picture, he had the real data, but when you look at the original Eddington photographs, the stars moved all over the place. They didn't move radially outwards and to the proper degree based on their distance from the center of the sun. That's what should have happened, but that's not what happened. The star movement was all over the place. Now what I'm going to do is give another experiment that was done. And the only reason I know about this is because I was at Cornell University when the data came in. Okay, so this is 1979 to 81 time frame. And during the, after the class, classes were over in the afternoon, typically there was so much going on. The Voyagers, the Pioneer spacecraft, there were all kinds of spacecraft around in outer space, taking data, sending data back. So every day after the classes got over in the afternoon, everybody would head up to this big auditorium kind of room in the physics space science department at Cornell and look at the data coming in the would-be raw data from the spacecraft. And one of them was the following. There was a spacecraft that was in orbit around Venus. And so Venus, the position of Venus, because of our understanding of the orbits of the planets, etc., the position of Venus is very, very well known. And the position, therefore, of the satellite orbiting Venus was very well known. Well, at the time, Venus was going to pass around behind the sun. And there's, of course, the radio signal on the spacecraft is signaling back to Earth. So the belief was that that radio signal, being electromagnetic radiation, should bend according to the prediction of general relativity. And so as the spacecraft orbiting Venus started to move around behind the sun, they were taking the data, the position data, and all of a sudden this thing started bouncing all over the place, up and down and sideways and back and forth, and they couldn't understand what the problem was. It was not following general relativistic predictions, which should be pretty basic. The mass of the sun is very well known. The structure of the sun is very well known. in terms of the mass of the sun is not radically changing on a minute-to-minute basis. It's not, and there's, you know, all this, the basic bottom line is that the data didn't make any sense. So the session, the data session, turned into a kind of a badminton session or a tennis match, people bouncing ideas back and forth as to what could be the cause of this data not following general relativistic predictions. And I'm sitting there watching this, understanding that these are electrical effects. I had already devised my induced electric dipole redshift showing that the bending of light is not due to gravity, but it's due to an electromagnetic effect. Okay, so anyway, I'll have a little more time to discuss that at the end of this show. So anyway, here's again another proof that general relativity is incorrect. I'll get back to the Eddington experiment and how thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of amateur astronomers can use the upcoming solar eclipse to disprove general relativity. And this you can do yourself. Take a picture of the star map of the sky, the region where the solar eclipse is going to be. Okay, and then you take a picture of that same region of the sky when the total eclipse is going on and compare them. And what you're going to find is that the stars are going to be bouncing around all over the place. And it's not going to be radially moving outwards as predicted by general relativity. Neither the amount of movement nor the direction of movement will follow what general relativity predicts. And any amateur can prove this for themselves. So you don't have to depend on PhDs with government-supported telescopes to prove this. Any amateur can do this. Okay, one more thing I'm going to throw into the monkey wrench here, into the system, into general relativity. And this happened in the mid-1980s. A comet called Halley's Comet came through the solar system, and there was a flotilla of spacecraft that went out to see it. But the United States did not put one up there. Maybe they did, and they didn't tell us about it. They were too afraid of getting data back that actually would indicate that my theoretical work is right. And I can tell you from my own experience that the Tier 1 scientists know very well that my work is correct, 100%. And, you know, there's just no question that comets are not dirty snowballs. But anyway, this group of NASA scientists went to South America to look at Halley's Comet, and they took spectrometers and telescopes. So the idea was to look at the spectral nature of the comet, of Halley's Comet, because it would be a very bright, beautiful comet. And what they noticed was that there was a redshift. Okay, so what are the known causes of redshifts? Well, the main one dealing with light is due to special relativity. That means if an object is moving away from you, then it would give a redshift. If it's moving towards you, it would give a blue shift. And this is similar to a train. If you've ever been near a train track and the train is coming down the track and it's blowing its horn and it goes like this. And when it's coming at you, it has a higher frequency, a higher sound, higher frequency sound. And then when it passes and starts going away from you, it has a lower frequency sound because it's going away from you. It's stretching the wavelength relative to your position and the moving train. And it's the same thing that happens with light. It's a little different because you're dealing with relativistic speed of light types of things, but it's essentially the same. So if something is coming at you, it should be blue shifted towards the blue or higher frequency. And if it's going away from you, it should be redshifted or stretching out the wavelength and therefore giving you a lower frequency. The only problem was that the comet was not moving away. And so there was no reason for a redshift. The other thing is that one might invoke, for example, the general relativistic redshift, which would be caused by light leaving a very massive, supermassive object. But wait a minute. Comets are little poofy snowballs with hardly any mass at all, according to standard theory. So that didn't work either. So there's no known reason for comets to have a redshift. So what did they do? They threw the data away. They didn't publish it. Yeah, that's what happens in standard science. If the data doesn't fit the theory, hey, the data gets tanked. That's what happens. So all along, this whole issue has been a fraud. The whole issue of general relativity, which is one of the supporting pillars of the Big Bang concept, which I'll talk about, hopefully get a little bit of that in also. But right now I want to concentrate on the general relativistic experiment of Eddington. So let me review that now. So I've given you a few examples of other experiments that should have verified general relativity. They did not, and they threw away the data because they didn't know what to do. Instead of, and I was in attempts to publishing my work, and they buried it. They would not allow that work to be published as part of, trying to destroy my career. And of course, what they do is they do two things. They go after your income, and then they go after your livelihood, your job. So they get rid of your job, they get rid of your income, and they hope you go away and never come back. Well, they were wrong about me, because I came back with going directly to the public, bringing my work directly to the public, and they really don't like that. See, scientists are supposed to be humble little puppy dogs with a little skinny tie and go to their American Geophysical Union meetings and have their way paid. I call them scientific vacations because it's really if they go to Japan, then next week it's India, then next week it's the United Kingdom, then after that it's New Zealand, then after that it's sunny California, how about sunny Florida, you know, and they're flying all over the world, you know, putting out basically garbage science. This is the level of tier two science. But like I say, the tier one scientists know absolutely that I'm correct about all of this. Okay, but on to the Eddington experiment. So here we go back. Special relativity has been proven. And I mentioned this on a previous show. Of all of the amazing work that Einstein did, where he put the key in the lock and turned it and opened up an entirely new direction in physics. Amazing work. And there, like I said before, there were possibly 20 discoveries that Einstein made that were Nobel Prize quality work, you know, the discoveries. Special relativity probably would have been right up there. I mean, and with general relativity proven, general relativity was a far more complicated theoretical structure, and supposedly it was proven. So why did they give Einstein the Nobel Prize for the photoelectric effect? Just this kind of minuscule thing, which was a very important discovery. It was instrumental in understanding the nature of light and the and quantum physics. It was a very important discovery, theoretical discovery at explaining data that existed, etc. But why would they give the Nobel Prize for the photoelectric effect when these other things, in if you rank them from 1 to 20, the major discoveries of Einstein, the photoelectric would probably been about 13th. General relativity and special relativity would probably be number one and two, but they didn't give him the Nobel Prize for that. So that always has me kind of scratching various my head about that. Anyway, that's an aside note. But anyway, Einstein did not believe general relativity the way it was structured with just gravity. He was always concerned that somehow gravity affected light, and we didn't know any effects from electromagnetism fields, electromagnetic fields that would affect light. So he said there's something missing here, and he expressed that in a book that he wrote, his autobiography, Out of My Later Years. And in the very end of the book, he says he didn't believe general relativity because it did not include the total field. And what was Einstein working on when he died? He was working on what is known as the grand unification of the fields. So you have gravity, you have electricity, you have magnetism, you have the nuclear forces, which were known when in Einstein's time, and other subatomic forces that were well known and understood at the time. And so he was trying to combine these and find a way to put them together into one unified field theory. And that's what he was studying. And that study still goes on today, somewhat in the background. Now you have dark matter, dark energy, a bunch of things that had to be created to put band-aids on failed theories like the Big Bang. But anyway, back to general relativity. Einstein did not like the way general relativity was structured. Now, let me be clear. The curved space-time structure, where you have these masses moving around in outer space, it's kind of like this. And you've probably all been to like a museum, or it might be a planetarium or something, or some kind of public place, and they have this. It's like a circle, it's like a bin type of thing, and you put a quarter or a penny or something in this trough, and it rolls down, and it rolls around this 1/r² shape, and it rolls around, and friction eventually causes the penny, and air resistance, both friction and air resistance, cause the coin to circle in, and then it goes down into a hole. And I always said, I wish I had that deal, because everybody's putting their money in that like crazy, watching the go down, and some people will put two in and watch them see if they'll collide, etc. It's very interesting. But then there are people who've made that same thing, but with some kind of a fabric, so that when something rolls around, it not only rolls around on this hard surface, but it also rolls around and makes an indentation. So that is one of the closest things to curved space-time in the real world example, everyday example that we have. So where the weight or and they're using little stainless steel balls, or steel balls of some kind, so they make an impression. And so, say one object comes by another one, well, their little troughs interact, and they swing towards each other. It's a very good example of gravitational interaction. Okay, so at any rate, just want to stress that Einstein did not believe general relativity in that it bent light around stars and caused a redshift. Something else was going on. And then this leads to the whole issue of what we hear about all the time now, black holes. And even comedians are kidding about this, because now they're saying there are suitcase-sized black holes. Little teeny black holes out there that are causing, anyway, it is kind of humorous, because black holes supposedly are eating everything in the universe, and eventually everything will go in there and nothing can come out. Well, it turns out that that doesn't work either. That only works in a curved space-time continuum, where time is stretched. And as objects fall in, you should see X-rays, and then the redshifting of X-rays as things fall in, particles, matter, etc. And recently, in the last couple of years, people have been touting taking photographs of black holes, which is nonsense. How can you take a picture of something where light can't escape, where the light cannot come out of there? How can you take a picture of it? But they're claiming they do. At the center, in the constellation Sagittarius, is the center of our galaxy. The Milky Way galaxy is the center is off there. And they're saying they can take a picture of the black hole at the center of the galaxy. So this term black hole is bantered around within astrophysics circles like a tennis ball, when in reality, if general relativity is not true, then the whole issue of the time dilation, etc., going along with it is not true. Not to say there are not massive objects out there, it's just that they do not compress in the manner that is predicted by general relativity, because general relativity itself has some issues. So you have to understand that when you're the division between reality and non-reality when you're dealing with general relativity, because some parts of it are correct and some parts are not. But the thing I'm concentrating on tonight is the bending of light. So is light being bent as it comes by stars or galaxies? Because you see these rings and there is bending of light going on. There is. But it's not caused by gravity. It's caused by the induced electric dipole redshift, and that is a property of the proton wind, an excess current of proton wind around fusion-based objects. And that's in my work that's published, and that's literally what's going on. But the point of me talking about the eclipse coming up on April 8th is that many people, amateur astronomers, have the equipment at their disposal to go out and disprove general relativity for themselves. Like I say, you don't have to depend on NASA. You don't have to depend on, some university professor with a big telescope down in South America or someplace. So let me be very specific here about exactly what one would have to do. Okay, so what would you do? You have a telescope, you're an amateur. You have the solar eclipse coming up here on April 8th, and you've got your plans, you've got the place to go. All you need is a parking lot. You don't need anything else, any special equipment. And just remember, I'm going to preface this by saying, if you're an amateur, if you're semi-professional, whatever, do not look at the sun. Even there's that kind of temptation, even as the total eclipse is coming about, you can damage your eyes by looking at the sun. So never use optical equipment, and never look at the sun directly. So you should always have properly designed equipment, and there are filters for looking at the sun that you can put on your telescope, but you would not use that filter when you were taking a picture of the total eclipse and the star background. And so what you'll see is the solar corona, which is this series of rays that come out from the sun. And those are the high energy electrons that are in orbit around the sun, basically. And then you would be able to see the stars, just like nighttime. So you would want to take, when the solar eclipse is total, you want to take pictures of the star background. That's what you're looking for, is the star background, and they're going to move. The other thing you have to do is take a picture of the sky, that very same region of the sky, with your telescope at a on a given night, where you see that same region of the sky but without the sun there. So you have the two to compare, and with the same magnification, etc. And then what you're going to do is compare the movement. Now, in the old days, there was a piece of equipment called a blink comparator, it was called, in which you would put two photographic plates. Sometimes these would be the negatives, not the positive prints, but you would take the negatives, slide them in one side, one in the other, and it was like an optical device which would switch back and forth between the two plates. And then you would turn some screws to line them up so that when you were looking at one plate, the stars were all in one spot. And when then it switched over to see the other plate, all of those stars would be in the same spot. But what would happen is, say there was an asteroid or a comet in the field of view, it would move. And that would be moving back and forth as the blink comparator went from one film to the other. And this is, by the way, what Harrington did back in the 1980s, when they were searching for Planet X, when he was down in New Zealand. That's what he was doing. He was taking the photographic plates, he'd bring them back to Washington, to the Naval Observatory, to look for the movement, and he discovered the movement. And then he went back again a year later to get the final readings and get the orbit. And I talk about that in my book, The Real History of Planet X, Update 2020. And so that book is available on my webpage. By the way, my webpage is all new. It's all set up for ordering now. You can order individual books. You can order libraries. You can order the video sets, the CDs, DVDs, etc. Okay. Anyway, jmccsci.com. Back to reproducing the Eddington experiment. So it's that simple. You take a picture of the sky with the total eclipse complete. In other words, the moon is completely blocking out the sun. And you take a picture so you get the star field. Very important that you do a time-lapse photography where you get the star field, where you get the position of the stars. Then you take a with the camera and telescope set at exactly the same settings, you take a picture of that region of the sky at night with the same telescope setup, but without the sun in that position. Now you compare them, and there should be movement. And if general relativity were true, what should happen is for stars that are farther away from the sun, their movement should be less and less, and it should be a certain amount, because we know what those stellar positions are and what the bending of light should be. And the farther out you go, the less the effect should be, the gravitational bending of light, which you're going to find out doesn't exist. And then also all of the movement should be in the radial direction from the center of the sun outwards, moving outwards. And what you're going to find is the movement of the stars is going to be all over the place. The vector of movement, it'll be sideways, it'll be up and down, it'll be over to the other side, and it's going to be all over the place and not at all based on the radial distance from the center of the sun. That's what you're going to find. And that's what Eddington found. But he cherry-picked the data, and he threw out all the data points that didn't fit, and he proclaimed success for general relativity. So we have been 100-plus years, 110, 115 years, with the belief that general relativity has been proven on a bogus experiment done by somebody who cherry-picked the data and threw most of the data away. And, of course, the incentive there was to become the smartest man of the world, because Eddington then was honored as a physicist who was one of the very few people in the world who could understand general relativity. And like I say, up until his death, Einstein did not believe it himself, and he was the one who invented it. The other thing I want to mention about Einstein is that when he died, he had the book by Velikovsky, Worlds in Collision, open on his desk. He had everything pushed aside, and he's reading Worlds in Collision because Velikovsky, who was his good friend at Princeton, and I know that because my good friend Warner Sizemore was Velikovsky's personal secretary, was with him all the time when Einstein would come over to the house, play violin before supper, and they would talk. And, of course, I have interviews with Warner Sizemore on my webpage, on my CDs. The two CD set, the MP3 on the Physics of Planet X and Ancient Celestial Disasters, I have a series of interviews with Warner Sizemore, Velikovsky's personal secretary. Okay, so at any rate, Einstein did not believe in this, and the reason he did not is because it did not include electromagnetic fields. And of course, what I discovered was the real cause for the bending of the light, the induced electric dipole redshift. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about a guy named Halton Arp. Halton Arp was a scientist who took data, basically galactic redshifts, etc. And what he noticed is that many quasars were physically, you could see the visible connections, like, and these were actually electrical connections between low redshift galaxies and high redshift quasars. And they were physically connected in all the different regions of the electromagnetic spectrum, in X-rays, in ultraviolet, in visible light, in infrared, in microwave, all of them showed this connection. So it was a very real connection between the galaxy. And he had hundreds of these photos. And you could say, well, if he had one photo, okay, that was coincidence. But basically, the astronomy community defiled him. And now, mind you, many scientists, hundreds of scientists are coming back and saying HARP was correct. And they're taking data and they're showing data that is indicative of what HARP did, Halton Arp. What he did was to show that the redshift was not an indication of distance. And the Hubble constant, now let me just explain the Hubble constant a little bit here. What happens is the people who believe in the Big Bang, okay, the higher the redshift, that means the farther away the thing went, the fastest. And so therefore they have a Hubble constant, which indicates how far away these objects are given their redshift. It's based, so the higher redshift objects are farther away. That's the belief. So there's a Hubble constant that gives you an equation. And here's, so anyway, these hundreds of scientists are now complaining because they're being censored. They're being censored by the political establishment in science, something that I've been saying probably before a lot of these scientists were even born. This is my fight against the establishment science industry at Cornell when I was there. And I publicly stated these people are fudging data. They're incorrect about their theories, and it's incorrect. They're basically fudging data. That's what I said. Okay, so now I'm going to switch gears just a little bit and talk about recent discoveries by the James Webb Telescope. As you know, the James Webb Telescope is the next generation after the Hubble Space Telescope, looking out, and what they're able to do is allegedly see towards literally to the beginning of the universe at the Big Bang, but what they're discovering are fully developed galaxies that should have taken billions of years to develop. So how could fully developed galaxies be there right next to the Big Bang? Well, of course, it's what I've been saying all along. The bigger telescope that you build, the more you're going to see what we've been seeing all along right in our own local world and universe over here in this side of the universe. You're going to just see a continuation of the same thing, and that's what they're seeing. So there's heavy questioning of the Big Bang. I've made it clear that the microwave background radiation is not from the Big Bang. It's from a dust cloud that surrounds our solar system. It's part of the nebular ion cloud that is held back by solar wind pressure. And so hopefully maybe this year the axe will finally fall on this incorrect science that has been dominating the scene for the last 100 plus years. Okay, just quickly, I've got a few minutes left here, but I just want to encourage people, amateur scientists, amateur astronomers, go out there and take your own data and disprove general relativity. Now, this is not against Einstein because he was, and remember, curved spacetime is very valuable. There's the tensor analysis, the understanding of gravitational fields, and curved spacetime is very important and very correct. It's this part where they include electromagnetic radiation and bending of light. Gravitational lensing is not correct, and that's the incorrect part of general relativity. Very important to understand what I'm saying here, what's true and what's not true. Just quickly, I've still got a sale on my water filters on the water filter page, jmccwaterfilters.com, 30% off. In fact, the MR5 whole house water filter best deal, it's normally retail $23.80. It's now $13.80, literally $1,000 off. And what we've done is set aside a few units that we're going to sell off at that price. And once they're sold, then the price is going to go back up to normal. And so anyway, that's going on right now. So get there, take advantage of that sale so you have clean water for the whole house. The MR5 whole house water filter best deal, literally $1,000 off. And so anyway, the webpage jmccwaterfilters.com. And like I say, go to my main webpage, jmcanniescience.com. Use the short URL, jmccsci.com, jmccsci.com, 7 letters. And you can get from there to the water page, the water filter page also, with a link. And all of my books, my CDs, the videos, etc., are now, you can buy them individually, etc., on the webpage, jmccsci.com. Just quickly, today is the spring solstice. And so anyway, we are at the day where the day is equal to the night in terms of length of time. This is where we switch over. Now the days start getting longer in the northern hemisphere. The southern hemisphere had their summertime, and now they're heading into winter. So at any rate, and very interesting that this total eclipse is coming up here in a few days. And there's all kinds, by the way, there's all kinds of buzz on the internet about the name of towns and things like that. Please don't fall for a lot of this hype. There could be a major earthquake. In fact, remember that the crazies that manipulate weather, etc., like that, they also have the ability to create earthquakes by vibrational electromagnetic signaling in the ground. So it could be a false flag where they have a major earthquake that could be a false flag. We don't know. There's so much going on today, it's hard to even keep track of it all. Now, remember that I talk about Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3 science. In Tier 1, I call it military science. It's reality science. The people there understand what I'm talking about. If they listened to this, they would be in 100% agreement, everything I said. The problem is you have Tier 2 science. This is what you would call NASA or peer-reviewed journals, etc. People ask, why don't I publish in peer-reviewed journals? Many reasons. First of all, you give away your information and you lose the rights to it. So I don't do that. I publish my own material. I own my material. I own the publication rights to it. And also, it's a big racket. That's the best thing you could call it. Peer-reviewed journals. The real science does not get published in peer-reviewed journals. Let me just tell you that. So at any rate, remember to go to my webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com. Get that huge sale on the MR5 whole house water filter. I also have my gravity water filter elements there. The best products on the planet. And those things sell like hotcakes. People really love those gravity water filters. But I recommend people get a whole house water filter. And then go to the webpage jmccsci.com for my books, etc. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.